Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, Fresno's Transit Department is the latest city service to face the budget axe, why the city says it has to cut salaries. We will have the latest on the petition drive aimed at letting voters have the final say on the effort to outsource residential trash service. Plus, the flu outbreak. Is it about to take over the Central Valley? And a Valley musical favorite. All those stories coming up on Valley Edition. But first, the city of Fresno has deep budget woes. In an effort to increase revenues, officials voted to have a private company take over its solid waste service and is busy slashing the salaries of its workers. The latest department to come under scrutiny for savings is transit. The city's negotiation with Fresno bus drivers shows just what workers and city leaders are up against when it comes to trying to solve Fresno's budget crisis. Drivers who operate the city's bus service called Fresno Area Express will tell you that despite what some may think, theirs is not a cushy job.
It's the equipment. It's riding in a seat. You're constantly bouncing up and down. You're constantly turning the steering wheel. There's a number of knee problems, shoulder problems, hand problems by repetitive motion. You do the job for a number of years, and for some people it takes its toll.
Rick Stites, president of the union that represents FACTS drivers who belong to the Amalgamated Transit Union, or ATU, speaks up for the 200-plus drivers whose work rules and practices came under fire during the city's negotiations with the union. At a city council meeting in December, Stites defended the drivers' high workers' compensation claims.
Let me talk to you about attendance. I don't know if they pointed this out to you. There are about 210 bus drivers. On any given day, there are between 13 and 23 employees off on work injury. A lot of that has to do with equipment.
High workers' comp claims, high rates of absenteeism, and overtime were all issues in the city's failed negotiations with the transit union.
Those are the kind of things that tried to reform some of the work rules. And it's hard to change things once you've got them.
Fresno City Councilman Lee Brand says the city was also asking for a 3% wage reduction. After 18 months, there was no agreement. The two sides had reached an impasse, and a fact finder was called in.
By state law, you bring in a neutral fact finder mediator to look at all the facts, come up with a report, and both sides meet again. But neither side is compelled to go with the recommendations.
The fact finder's recommendation was indeed split, agreeing with some of the city's proposals and supporting some of the union's work practices. The independent findings did not support pay cuts. This is what Tony Whittington, a member of the fact-finding panel, told city council members.
My name's Tony Whittington. I'm an international representative for Amalgamated Transit Union. These employees have gone 4 years without a wage increase in this unit, where other employees in the same unit have gotten wage increases. So that was a very big, to the fact-finding panel, a very big issue. But when you look at your attendance, they were running 10 employees short.
Like other city employees, FACTS drivers were negotiating with the city with huge budget problems and looking for ways to save money. So when no agreement could be reached, the city council voted to impose a one-year labor agreement. The agreement included the 3% wage reduction. Rick Stites is considering the union's options.
There's a couple options. One is to just continue to work under the imposed working conditions. One is to have an economic action, a strike. And the third one, which I'm currently trying to pursue, is get back to the negotiation table.
Stites wants to fight the 3% pay cut and says he has a plan that wouldn't cost the city any more money. But officials say wages aren't the only problem. Fresno Area Express is an enterprise department. Just like solid waste, it is a fee-based service. The difference? While trash generated money, fax is operating at a deficit.
The bottom line was the enterprise fund was losing about $1.2 million a year because the gasoline tax, state, federal grants that fund this were all dropping because of the economy.
The funding problem made worse by past council members' unwillingness to raise bus fares. Until 2011, rates hadn't been raised in 10 years. City Councilman Oliver Bain says it's a problem across the board.
You hear the charge all the time from people in different political circles that say, we need to run government more like a business. Well, I agree with that to some extent. Government and business are very different, but there is some overlap. And at a bare minimum, government should charge, when it's a fee-based service, we should charge what it costs to deliver that service to the public.
Just last week, the city's Transit Rates and Services Committee recommended the city raise bus fares by 75 cents over 5 years. It's not expected to be an easy sale.
Anytime you're talking about raising anything, whether it's raising taxes or raising rates, it's always a fight, and it's okay. It should be a fight, but what I do believe is that when you're honest with people and you're transparent with them and you tell them the truth, and the truth is we do have a revenue problem. We do not have a spending problem.
The city's negotiations with bus drivers and its decision to privatize the solid waste department are part of the ongoing effort to find savings in every department and to generate revenue. While management and labor may disagree on how to accomplish that goal, one thing they will agree on is the budget is in crisis.
The general fund? It's in terrible shape. I wouldn't argue that with anybody.
While some city officials have likened Fresno to cities like Stockton and San Bernardino that have filed bankruptcy, Fresno City Manager Mark Scott says Fresno is not going bankrupt and doesn't face the long-term liability problems with its retirement and pension funds.
In the city of Fresno, we don't have the long-term liabilities. We don't have a huge amount of debt service, for instance. What we do have, worse than those other cities, is a cash flow problem.
A cash flow problem brought on by not only a shortage of revenue, but the past administration's decision to float revenue bonds to help pay for the baseball stadium, parking garage, and other projects. City officials say those bonds just about doubled the general fund debt service.
We not only don't have general fund reserves in our budget, we're actually negative in the more than $20 million negative in our fund balances.
Scott says the city has no cash reserves to fall back on if anything were to happen. And since revenues aren't showing much growth, Fresno has to bring its expenses in line with its revenues. That plan includes the $2.5 million in franchise fees the city is getting from the private company that is taking over the trash service.
And it also includes getting compensation reductions from all of our employees across the board.
Scott says he's seeking a reduction in salaries, not because he thinks city employees are paid too much. He says the budget situation leaves him no choice. The alternative would be to lay off even more workers.
I don't want to go deeper. I think I have to try to make the cuts in compensation, being 81% of our total city budget. And we have to do things like the revenues from the franchise. If we don't get that, we get problems.
Last Friday, opponents of Fresno's effort to privatize residential solid waste service delivered thousands of signatures to City Hall. It is the latest step in a high-stakes battle over the future of city services and finances. FM 89's Ezra Romero has this report.
The waiting game has just begun for both sides in the battle over the outsourcing of Fresno's residential trash service. For the past month, opponents of Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen's plan to outsource the city's home trash service have hustled to collect signatures in order to meet a January 18th deadline to put the decision in the hands of voters.
Do you know about the trash privatization? The city is selling off all trash services.
More than 50 people escorted around 35,000 signatures in 7 sealed white boxes into the city clerk's office on Friday.
We are here so proud to deliver just under 40,000 signatures.
That was Marina Magdalena, the business representative of Local 39, the garbage truck drivers union that spearheaded the petitioning. But despite the thousands of signatures, opponents of the mayor's proposal have their fingers crossed. The group needs just under 22,000 valid signatures in order to put the decision on the ballot. If the opponents of the legislation truly gathered enough signatures, then the city has two options: repeal the action or hold a special election, an election that some say could cost around $1 million.
We really just need to look out for the good for our entire city. And if the city goes bankrupt, then they're not going to have those jobs nor those dues. So, I mean, what's the point? $1 million burden on the city for a special election is almost reckless, in my opinion.
That was Edgar Blunt, an outsourcing supporter and board member of Fresnans for Responsible Government, an advocacy group that has helped fund opposition to the petition drive. The city hopes to give its 105,000 residential trash accounts to Fresno-based Mid-Valley Disposal in return for a $1.5 million signing bonus and an annual $2.5 million in franchise fees to the city's general fund. The city council approved the deal December 20th of last year. Swearingen says the privatization will prevent what she calls a fiscal emergency. The deal, if passed, will run for 9 years, have almost an 18% rate cut for the first 21 months, ensure rate hike caps for the remaining 7 years, and force Mid-Valley to keep on any city employees affected by the change for at least 1 year. That led opponents to launch a 30-day campaign to put the issue in front of voters. Outsourcing opponents said they oppose the mayor's decision for a number of reasons. Beverly Fitzpatrick, a retired teacher, says there is no reason to cut trash service.
I'm a taxpaying citizen, and so far I've had no problem with my trash pickup.
Fresno garbage man Richard Martinez agrees.
They have countless awards. Best in the nation recycling. Probably the one good thing that Fresno is known for. Other than that, you got crime, you got shootings, you got dirty freeways, but their garbage department is award-winning. Why would you do that? Why do you kill a goose to serve that lays a golden egg served for Christmas?
The signature campaign wasn't always easy. In fact, outsourcing opponents said at times it got downright nasty. When outsourcing opponents hired a firm to help them collect signatures, supporters said the public were being misguided. But that was only the beginning. Outsourcing supporters launched a campaign to educate the public on the issues by hiring paid signature gatherers. The group sent out mailers, aired radio ads, and made phone calls. In response, the city took the unusual step of allowing those who had signed the petition to revoke their signatures by filling out a form online or at City Hall. Sue Beavers, a quality control worker in Fresno, disapproved of the way outsourcing supporters ran their campaign.
I was furious because I came home at the end of a long day, turned on my answering machine, and got a message that was purporting to be Ashley Swearingen's opinion. I felt that my home had been invaded. I signed a petition. I'm an adult. I know why I signed the petition. I don't want somebody telling me that I'm wrong.
So what's next for Fresno's green and blue trash cans? Over the next 30 days, the signatures will undergo the scrutinizing eye of City Clerk Yvonne Spence and Fresno County Clerk of Voters Brandy Orth. Spence will check to see that the signature on each petition matches the printed name. The 3-day job will take 10 temporary workers and may cost in the ballpark of $3,000. The 7 boxes will then be transferred to Orth's office. County workers will enter the information into a database and compare petition signatures to those on file, which may cost up to $45,000. The results will be sent to Spence, who has the final say in whether the petition was successful. But City Manager Mark Scott says that even if the petition goes to a vote and the deal is rejected, it's his job to keep the city out of the red.
That means we have to make cuts somewhere else, and it means we have to make cuts right away because we don't have enough time left in this fiscal year to make up the difference if we don't start right away. So we're waiting to see the outcome, hoping that we go forward with the franchise, and if we don't, we have to make some cuts in other places that probably involve people losing jobs.
Even if the city is successful in privatizing residential trash service, it still would have 5 months to close a $5 million budget gap. Scott says even more cuts will be necessary if it doesn't get the money from Mid-Valley. Although it's too early to tell, Scott expects cuts to come from the same places they have come from in recent years, Parks, public safety, and programs like senior hot meals may get the short end of the stick. But despite the uncertainty, opponents said they are glad the community came together on the issue, leaving a clear message to city higher-ups.
You need to listen to the people, especially when this is such an important decision that is going to affect our lives, our pocketbook, for eternity.
If the petition is not successful, residential trash service will switch to Mid-Valley on March 4th. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra Romero.
Earlier this morning, a group calling itself Fresnans for Clean Air announced it will file a lawsuit today against the city. The group claims that the effort to privatize residential solid waste is a violation of the California Environmental Quality Act. In the lawsuit, backers say the city should have prepared an environmental impact study to assess how the project would affect traffic and air quality. They also say the city failed to give proper notice to the public before voting on the issue. The group called on the city council to rescind its vote. In our next story, for many, the Kings County town of Kettleman City is just a convenient stop on the way to the Central Coast. But for the people who live there, it is a much different story. A life in what some have called one of the most polluted communities in the valley. But now some residents are taking the effort to reduce pollution into their own hands. Valley Public Radio's Rebecca Plevin has this report.
Anna Martinez was standing on a street corner in the tiny farmworker community of Kettleman City when she heard a familiar sound.
We'll see how long he's going to idle. He's just now starting his truck. So, see all the emissions, black smoke. Black smoke.
She pointed to four diesel trucks parked nearby. The lot was just one block from State Route 41 and another block or so from a huge agricultural field. Martinez is a community organizer with Green Action for Health and Environmental Justice. The San Francisco-based organization partners with area residents to improve health and reduce pollution in Kettleman City. That's a big job in this community, which, among other concerns, is home to one of the largest toxic waste landfills in the West.
When these farmers are spraying their fields, you know, now you have the pesticides, the diesel emissions. And not to talk about, you know, the drinking water, there's no good. I mean, it just goes on, and it adds to how bad this community is in Kettleman.
For several years, Green Action has partnered with local activists to fight the expansion of Waste Management's controversial landfill, which is located about 3.5 miles from Kettleman City. Recently, they focused their efforts on another issue, diesel emissions in Kettleman City and nearby Avenal. They couldn't do much about the diesel pollution stemming from the steady stream of traffic traveling along Highway 41, which cuts through Kettleman City as it connects the valley and the Central Coast. So, Green Action and several community members launched an education campaign to reduce the number of drivers that park their trucks within the community and leave their engines chugging.
The way we started this program was because we got a small grant. It was by the Fresno Regional Foundation and the EPA. And this was to start working in communities to educate truck drivers to reduce the idling and contamination in the communities.
So what's the big deal about diesel? According to experts, diesel exhaust particulate matter is a toxic air contaminant that can cause cancer, premature death, and other health problems.
Because these particles, especially if you're breathing them close to the source, they're still very, very small. And they will go deep into the lungs and where the air is transferred into the blood in the alveolar region, and they get absorbed into the bloodstream. So the smaller particles, you know, penetrate deeper into the lungs, and they're more likely to actually be absorbed.
That's David Lighthall. He's the health science advisor for the Valley Air District. He said diesel is a problem up and down the valley.
There's a whole string of neighborhoods that are adjacent to Highway 99. And, you know, 99 is going to be the primary risk zone where you're going to have the largest number of people exposed to the highest concentrations of diesel exhaust particles. And so I think what makes Kettleman City unique is the other potential risk, you know, factors that are down there. And they're not necessarily limited to airborne sources of risk, pollution.
Lighthall said it's generally difficult for people to avoid exposure to the ultra-fine diesel exhaust particles that are very common near roadways. For that reason, he praised the community's diesel campaign.
I think this is a fantastic project where community activists have actually gone out and they've engaged the business community and they've actually, it appears, obviously you'd like to see a sustained study and make sure that the trucks are continuing to do this, but, you know, they've reduced community impacts here.
18-year-old Jose Rodriguez participated in the diesel campaign. He'd time how long a parked truck ran its engine. If it idled longer than the legal limit of 5 minutes, he'd approach the driver and ask him to turn off the engine. He would also tell him about government grants that can help drivers retrofit or replace their diesel vehicles.
I just let him know that it was dangerous to them, to the environment, to their family.
As part of the campaign, 9 businesses signed good neighbor agreements and pledged to comply with idling laws. Anna Martinez again.
These good neighbor agreements are simply saying that if they're complying with the laws, all their trucks that they have will be reducing idling. And if any of these companies see their truck drivers or any other truck near their company idling, they're going to go out and let them know you cannot idle. It's against the law.
The campaign ran from April to December. Based on monitoring of idling hotspots at the beginning and end of the project, the campaign claims to have achieved up to a 91% reduction in diesel idling violations in Kettleman City and Avenal. Maria Saucedo is pleased with the results of the project. She is a resident of Avenal and a Green Action community organizer.
For me, it was good because the majority of truck drivers accepted that they have to turn off their motors and that it was affecting them. In time, we realized that they understood this information because now the trucks aren't idling for such a long time. They arrive and turn off the motors.
Saucedo's personal experiences motivate her to fight for a cleaner, safer community. Several years ago, Kettleman City gained national notoriety for an unexplained cluster of birth defects. Saucedo's daughter, Ashley, was one of the babies born with severe health problems. Ashley died in 2009. Saucedo gave birth to a healthy daughter later that year, but had a miscarriage in 2011. She's now 7 months pregnant and wants to ensure that her children grow up in a healthy environment.
As one of the affected mothers, I'm proud to be able to help people. I want there to be a change, and for me, this is a big change, even if it's not very noticeable. For us, it's an extraordinarily large health improvement. That's the truth.
Anna Martinez is confident that the reduction in diesel idling can be sustained. But the group could have a bigger fight on its hands. Waste Management is still seeking a permit to expand its hazardous waste landfill. If approved, up to 400 trucks could travel to and from the facility each day. A company spokesman said a small fraction of those trucks would drive directly through Kettleman City. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
Rebecca joins us now in the studio to talk more about the challenges in Kettleman City. We're also joined on the phone by Dr. Jonathan London, Assistant Professor of Human and Community Development at UC Davis. Dr. London has done extensive studies on pollution here in the Central Valley. Thank you, Dr. London, for joining us. And Rebecca, nice to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
It's nice to be here.
Well, first of all, Rebecca, tell us a little bit, just how bad is pollution in the Kettleman City area and the surrounding area?
Well, you know, it's really hard to quantify how bad the pollution really is in Kettleman City. As I mentioned in my report, there is this issue of diesel pollution that you have all these both trucks and cars passing along Highway 41, which runs right through the community. And the community is also located just a couple miles from Interstate 5, which is very heavily trafficked. Connects San Francisco and LA. Beyond the diesel pollution, there's this issue that I mentioned in my story about the community being about 3.5 miles from the largest toxic waste landfill in the West. And the facility is under strict health regulations, but, you know, community residents are still very concerned about the facility. Beyond those two concerns, the residents there can't drink the water. It's contaminated. They breathe in contaminated air. They live near fields that are heavily sprayed with pesticides. The Fresno Bee reported last week that treated human sewage from L.A. County will soon be composted on farmland near Kettleman City. So that community faces a lot of different challenges. Health risks, and it's hard to know how much all those together impact that community.
Professor London, what did you find when you looked at this region in your studies?
Well, we conducted research on what we called cumulative environmental vulnerability, and that included many of the same factors that Rebecca was just mentioning of environmental contaminants, environmental hazards, air quality, toxic releases to land and water, and then also looked at the distribution of what we called social vulnerability, of who lives in these places that are being affected by these burdens. So that's issues of poverty, low rates of English fluency, formal education, racial and ethnic concentration. And what we found is that there's about a third of the residents in the San Joaquin Valley that are facing what we would consider elevated or even extreme levels of cumulative environmental vulnerability, where environmental hazards and social vulnerability map onto each other. And that causes a tremendous risk and for health, poor health, as well as just a sense of being dumped on and neglected by government. And so that knowing this information, our hope is that that can really be a self-empowering and a rallying point for communities such as Kettleman City.
So what you're seeing is when we talk about social and the vulnerability of these areas, are we looking at some of the same types of communities that are being hit by this? I mean, they're poor communities. And
That's right. Generally, these are communities that where residents have lower incomes, that tend to have higher rates of poverty, therefore have greater concentrations of ethnic and racial minorities, although increasingly minority is an irrelevant term in California as it's becoming a majority state. But they're places where there are concentrations of people of color. And they really are spread out throughout the San Joaquin Valley. There are significant concentrations of these cumulative environmental action zones in urban centers, Fresno, Bakersfield, Stockton, Modesto, and so on, but also these smaller rural communities like Kettleman City, like a lot of the unincorporated communities along the east side of the valley. So it's really not a rural or urban issue. It's both.
You know, Rebecca, Kettleman City, when you take a look at it, it has been dealing with this problem for quite some time. Do you see anything different there? Is there anything changing? Is it getting any better or is it getting worse?
That's a tough question to answer. I've been covering issues in Kettleman City for 4 years now. When I first started covering that community, it was very clear that the residents had serious health concerns, and it didn't really seem to me like those concerns were being heard. And then you had this issue of these birth defects that appeared, and the community really gained national media attention. Governor Schwarzenegger ordered a study into that community. The U.S. Regional EPA director visited the community. So the community became a lot more high profile. But despite all that, you know, at this point, 4 years later, they're still facing similar health concerns. There's still this issue of whether the hazardous waste landfill is going to be able to expand or not. That decision could come this year. Who knows when it'll come. But when it does come, there's still that question. The decision might be more high profile at this point because of all the attention the community has received. So in some ways, the more things change, the more things stay the same. It's hard to really know.
Has the community become more active around this?
The community has been fighting this issue and others since the late 1980s, actually. I wrote a story a couple of years ago about three generations in one family that have been fighting this issue. So
it's just getting people to listen,
yeah.
as it seems.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the big question now, is there, you know, any going back or a way to kind of reinvent the health of the valley when it comes to pollution of the air, waterways, and the land, Dr. London? Because it just seems it's such a huge problem here.
It is. And one of the tenets of environmental justice, the environmental justice movement that takes on these kinds of issues of greater burden of environmental hazards on communities of color and low-income communities, that principle is it's called the precautionary principle, and it's the idea that risks are cumulative, and that when there's public policies being made or regulations being applied, that places that already have significant degrees of risk should have special consideration, as well as the decisions need to not depend on a final conclusive evidence that chemical A is causing this kind of health defect or health condition, but rather that there is some evidence that that may be happening, and so regulations need to take that kind of precautionary approach. And what we've found is these what we call cumulative environmental vulnerability action zones are places for that kind of proactive approach. They're not to be seen as areas of redlining where there shouldn't be investment. Actually, these are places that innovative and collaborative action can occur across different agencies, between community organizations and business organizations, where the most innovative science and the most innovative policy can be applied, as well as the most intensive engagement of those residents. And we called our report Land of Risk, Land of Opportunity, emphasizing not just the typical depiction of the San Joaquin Valley as this place of tremendous environmental hazard, but also a place of great opportunity with hardworking people, with, as Rebecca was saying, generations of community advocates working for the betterment of their community, leaders. David Lighthall was on the show in the earlier section, trying to be more responsive to community organizations. So I actually see great opportunity in the San Joaquin Valley, but it will be a long, hard journey.
What are some of the areas? We've talked about some of, you know, the poor outlying kind of farm community areas that have been hit the hardest by pollution, but it's in other parts of the region, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the major urban centers, you know, from north to south, Stockton to Bakersfield, there's really a patchwork pattern. We looked at sort of statistical areas called census tracts, and you can see some real differentiation often between the north side and the south side. The south being often sort of older communities as the communities sprawl north into suburban development. The south sides are left behind. So at south and west, so West Fresno, South Kern, South Stockton, and so on. So there really are those kinds of concentrated areas of risk. But it is important to mention communities that tend to be unincorporated. That is, they don't have municipal governance. They rely on the counties, county services, and county representatives. These communities, sometimes called disadvantaged unincorporated communities, often lack some of the basic infrastructure that's needed for health and well-being. So, sewers, sidewalks, sometimes they have unpaved streets, generally poor drinking water quality, and so on. So that's sort of a category of communities that really need some special attention.
Well, you know, these communities, we've talked about them, and there's been reports on them, and we've also talked somewhat a little bit about the health impact. So these residents, and we know some of this pollution is making them sick, what alternative do they have? Do they just continue to live there? Do they move? What's next for them?
Well, Rebecca may...
Rebecca, I wanted you to take that one on, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I would just say briefly, one of the things I've been really impressed by in the Central Valley, and not just there, but that residents have a really strong commitment to place. They don't just want to move. They've lived there. Some even haven't lived there for that long. Some are long-term residents. But there's this very strong orientation to making their communities a better place to live, to providing greater opportunities for their young people to stay in place, economic opportunities and educational opportunities to be able to build on the strengths of the place and not just leave. So, you know, in some cases, you know, that's a choice and a legitimate one to leave. But what I've been really excited about and what we're trying to support is providing people the information that they need to be able to mobilize and to take on the threats around them, but to do it in a proactive way.
Okay. Well, thank you both for this segment. It's very enlightening. I'm sure we're going to continue to cover this. Rebecca, you do a great job of looking at this issue. So we continue and we look forward to more of your reports. I'm Juanita Stevenson. You are listening to Valley Edition, and we will be right back.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. Well, we've seen the flu outbreak sweep across the country. Health officials are bracing for the outbreak to hit the Central Valley. Joining us now to talk about how health officials are gearing up for this is Letitia Barber. Berber. She's a health education specialist with the Public Health Department here in Fresno County. Letitia, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Juanita.
Let's talk a little bit about this outbreak. We've seen it move from east slowly to the west. And are we seeing cases here now? What are we expecting in the way of an outbreak?
Again, the county, Fresno County, has not seen any numbers of flu, but we have neighboring counties where they've seen deaths and higher numbers of flu cases. And yes, we are at the peak of the flu season, so we are encouraging people to vaccinate themselves against it. It's not too late. Again, the numbers here in Fresno County are not high to where we're saying, okay, we have an epidemic, we need to move fast. Again, the flu season started earlier this year in the nation, started in December. We usually see the flu season peak in January and February. But this year, during the flu season, we saw that it peaked early December, which is very unusual.
You know, the Central Valley, we've been through and we've seen these outbreaks before. And just because we live the way we live here, we usually have, you know, we usually have a pretty serious cases of the flu.
That's right. The flu and our asthma. Asthma cases do not combine very well. So, yes, people with asthma are at higher risk of getting flu complications, which may cause death during the flu season. So, yes, it's not uncommon to see high numbers of flu cases around here in Fresno County. Again, vaccine's available. It's available through doctors, health departments, pharmacies.
You know, so just because... You know, like we've seen in the East Coast, and we haven't heard those kind of reports here yet, people really shouldn't then sort of just let their guard down and feel like, oh, we're safe.
Exactly. Please don't assume that, okay, you know, it's not here in California, in Fresno County, there's not that many numbers. No, we really need to prevent this disease. And again, vaccinating is a way to go.
What are some of the other ways when it comes to the flu, what people can do to kind of fend it off?
Yes, stay home if you're sick. If you're feeling those symptoms of a runny nose, a fever, stay home. Don't keep your children home if they're sick. Stay away from public areas. Cover your cough and sneeze. Wash your hands. And the number one preventive measure is to vaccinate.
Especially if you are in an enclosed area. I'd say, like, if you're in a classroom or if you're in an office every day, you really need to kind of take those precautions.
Exactly. If you right now, we just finished the holiday season. We were all indoors celebrating, very close to other people. And now school started again. We're all in closed areas. Yes, if you're in closed areas for a very long time with other people, yes, you are at the risk of contaminating yourself and each other.
You know, we've sort of read mixed reviews about how bad the epidemic is in California. Where do we really stand? I mean, we've talked about the Central Valley. Have we seen, what about in other parts of California?
We've seen higher numbers in the LA County, San Diego County, which is unusual high numbers around for this time of year. But we here in Fresno County and other surrounding counties, we haven't really seen it as much as we've seen it in other states and in other counties. So are we safe from the flu? We're not. Again, this is the peak season right now, peak period. Do vaccinate yourself against it. You never know. It might hit next month where we see higher numbers. When it hits very hard. And it's if you haven't been vaccinated, it is hard to stop it.
Now, there are two different ways to get vaccinated.
Yes.
Aren't there?
Yes. You can get an injectable vaccine or you can get a nasal spray.
And they recommend one or the other for depending on your age, your population, the population, right?
That's right. If you have asthma, if you have diabetes or any health conditions, we recommend the injectable vaccine. If you have if you are between the ages of 2 and 49 years of age, healthy, no asthma, not pregnant, we recommend the nasal spray. And that's what we're doing at the health department. We have plenty of flu mist, especially for children who don't like the injectable. If you have your child healthy, no asthma, healthy child, and not sick, come in and get the flu mist out of the health department.
And so you're saying at the health department you have plenty of vaccination. Have you checked at any of, you know, hospitals, doctor's offices that everybody's okay when it comes to having enough vaccine?
Mm-hmm. If you're in Fresno County, there's plenty of flu vaccine to go around.
And I think it really sometimes sort of depends on where you are. Let's say I went to my pharmacist to get the flu shot and I was going to put it off. It was a Friday. Mm-hmm. I was going to put it off to a Monday. Mm-hmm. And he said they'd gotten like 50 a supply of like 50 doses, uh-huh. And they were down to 10.
That's right.
So you never know.
Yeah, you never know. And then you have to think, too, that doctors get their flu batch in early July, early August. So they start administering the flu vaccine as early as August. And they do order enough for their high-risk patients sometimes.
Right, because I live in an area where there are a lot of retirees.
Exactly. You know. So those are the retirees. People with asthma, they are the priority for their doctors to get the flu vaccine. So if you're seeking the flu vaccine right now at your doctor's office, you may come across to, well, you know what, we don't have any. You are welcome to go to the pharmacy or the health department.
Who should fear or why should we fear the flu season?
Who should fear the flu season is anybody who has asthma, anybody who has a weak immune system, who's going through some cancer treatment, small children under the age of 5, those of individuals that work in hospitals. You want to protect yourself. You want to protect your clients, your patients, your little ones, because some of them are maybe too young to get vaccinated, especially the ones under 6 months of age. Those are the individuals that should be protected against the flu. And why should we fear the flu? The flu is deadly. Again, it can be prevented. It's easily preventable. The flu can cause other complications such as pneumonia or other severe lung infection, which can cause or lead to death.
Okay. Thank you very much, Letitia, for coming in. People, you hear this information. We may not be seeing a huge outbreak right now, but it could happen any day, and you kind of want to protect yourself and have that flu shot. Just one more question before we go.
Yes.
What do we need to know about? What do we know about this year's flu strain?
The flu strain is it is a little different than the last year's strain. So if you got vaccinated last year, you want to get another vaccine this year because the vaccine only lasts for 9 to 12 months. This year's flu vaccine is different from the last 2 years. So you want to get vaccinated because you'd have no immunity against that virus that's going around right now.
Okay. Thanks again, Letitia Berber, Health Education Specialist, Public Health Department of Fresno County. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you for the invitation.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Joining us now in our studio are two very special people, Oscar Spies and Janice Noga. Many of you may know Janice from all the years she's spent singing here in the Valley. But she and her husband have teamed up and written a play that they have been performing here now in the Central Valley for 11 years. And we want to talk to them a little bit about that. First of all, the name of it is Janka.
Yanka.
Yanka. Thank you. I'm sorry.
That's fine.
That's what I get for not reading this beforehand. Okay. Tell us a little bit. It's my understanding, Oscar, that you wrote the play. So tell me the story behind that.
Well, my mother was a Holocaust survivor. She survived Auschwitz and slave labor in Germany. She was liberated in Germany. And since I was a little kid, I always wanted to know her story and, you know, why she survived, how she survived. And she wouldn't talk about it very much. And when she did, it was always sort of in little bits and pieces, and it was very confusing. Like, oh, you were in Auschwitz, but why were you in Germany? How did you get from Auschwitz to Germany? And things like that. So I always, as I grew up and I wanted to be a writer, I wanted to write a play about her story. But it was hard for her to talk about it when I tried to interview her. And then after she passed away, her sister, my Aunt Betty, sent her an outline about the play I wanted to do, which was mostly fiction because I didn't really know the story. And then she said, I have your mother's letter. And I said, what letter? You know, and she said, I'll send it to you. So I got this letter, and it was written in Hungarian. I had to find somebody to help translate it. A Fresno resident, Nora DeWitt, helped me translate it for about 6 months every Saturday morning. And it's this letter to an uncle in America. It was written in 1945, and it told the complete story of how their family was taken from Sighet, Romania, to Auschwitz and to liberation eventually after slave labor in Germany. And it's a 60-page letter, and it was the basis for this play. It was very powerful. I mean, we cried every Saturday morning. It was amazing. And it was an eyewitness account, like you were in Auschwitz, you know.
So she just put it down all on paper. She wasn't able to talk to you about it, but she put it all down on paper.
A couple months after liberation, an uncle in America had learned that they had survived through the Red Cross, and he wanted to know what happened, just like I wanted to know what happened. And she sat down and wrote a 60-page letter to him, handwritten letter, and a little composition book, and with the memories fresh in her mind, and written as a letter, it was just it was phenomenal.
Janice, what is it like for you to play this person. First of all, you're the daughter-in-law. So what is it like for you to play her, to tell her story?
It's an honor. First of all, I knew a little bit about the Holocaust because she cornered me when I first met her, and she told me a little bit about it, and I was devastated because I had never heard firsthand about the atrocities. But then she didn't speak about it, and that's when I just met Oscar, and we weren't married. We were just good friends. To learn her story, Oscar had an agent in Los Angeles, and he said, "Your wife is an actress. Have her do some cold readings." And from that time, and that's almost 11 years ago, we have performed in Romania twice in her village. We have performed in Edinburgh at the festival, London, all over the United States, universities and theaters. And to tell her story, I get away from my ego. I put my little ego, in my hand and rub it up. Which one is it, Oscar? Tell the truth, Oscar. And then I leave it in the dressing room and I just pray. I give it to God and I say, let Janka tell her story. And I do it with her Hungarian accent. And then Janka appears. Janice is not there. And my son said when he saw the play, and he knew Janka, he loved her, mm-hmm. and he said, "Mom, it's the first time that I didn't see you up there. I saw Janka." And it is, we have performed in front of the family. There were only three survivors. She lost 63 members of her family in 1 year. And the one remaining sibling saw the play with the rest of the cousins from New York and Canada and Philadelphia. And it was quite amazing. And then doing it, performing it in Sighet, Romania, in her family's synagogue. And it was quite an honor.
For the cousins from Australia who came, her cousins from Australia, our cousins, came to Sighet, Romania. We were there in May.
In May.
Yeah, this past May. And so they got to see the play. Janice did the play in the
What was the it film. Like for both of you to kind of collaborate on this, both of you to work on this, you writing the play and your wife performing it? What's rehearsals like?
I usually leave her alone. I've asked her to do, you know, maybe tone it down here or something like that, or, you know, but she's nails it every time, and it's minimal. I don't direct it very much. It's minimally directed, but we've put it together in a simple way so we could tour it around the country, and it's worked beautifully.
It was a half an hour too long, and you can't have people sit too long to hear this kind of subject material. And so we went down to Hollywood for 3 weeks and we rented a theater. And even if people wouldn't show up, I mean, two nights, no one showed up. So I said, "Oscar, we rented this theater. We're going to perform this." And as we did it, the next morning we would talk about it and then we would feel what is not needed to push it forward and tell the story. And then we've had our professor from Fresno State, Jeanette Bryan, who just recently passed away. She was with us at every performance in this valley, up and down, writing little notes. And she said, "Find something new every night." She's an amazing woman.
What do you think separates this play about the Holocaust from, let's say, other media productions or representations of the Holocaust?
It's a true story. It's real. And Yanka, at the beginning of the play, she asks the audience, I have an idea. My son keeps telling me to tell him about the Holocaust, and I don't know what to do. I have an idea. I will tell you the story, and after you hear it, you tell me if I should tell him. Do we have a deal? It's a deal. And then she goes on and starts with sad things, and then she goes, oh, no, I am going to tell you happier things first. And then when it gets too difficult, she can't do any more. And then she talks about coming to America on the 4th of July. And her husband said, those flags are all for you. And she believed it. But her time in America was the happiest in her life. And her twin sons were everything. So for Oscar to write this beautiful play, it's an honor for both of us.
Let's talk a little bit about the show. Who do you think should go? Tell us a little bit about where it's going to be.
It's at Cafe 210 in Visalia, the Saturday night at 7 o'clock, and it's a story for, you know, for everybody. School kids. We've done it for a sixth grade class here in Fresno, and they were amazing. The teacher prepped them, and they had a lot of questions. So it's for junior high, high school. There's some real difficult parts of the story in Auschwitz and in slave labor. And Yanka had a little salty personality sometimes, so we didn't. Well, that's in there. So, it's for a general audience, you know. And Cafe 210 is a terrific performance space in Visalia, and for a venue for Yanka, it's just perfect. It'll be very intimate. It's a very intimate, personal story. There won't be a dry eye in the house at the
end.
So
it's this Saturday?
This Saturday.
Okay. And at 7?
7 o'clock.
This Saturday.
And it's being sponsored by Congregation Beit Shalom in Visalia, and it's the money that's raised will go to their Holocaust education programs.
And where do they get tickets?
There's a phone number on that list there. The phone number there, just call that phone number. Give it to me and I'll.
Okay. I see it here, the 308.
Yes.
1333 number.
Right.
And either, like you said, you can get them at Cafe 210 or you can call 308-1333. And just hearing you go into part of that play right now was just wonderful. Thank you both for coming in. I don't think we'd want to miss, and I think it's a great opportunity for everybody. I really don't think you can tell this story enough. Again, Yanka, a play by Oscar Spies and Janice Noga, Saturday, January 26th, 7 p.m. at Cafe 210.
Thank you.
Thank you both for coming in. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.